you've met quite a few people like Chris Brown, Beyonce, Diana Ross. What has kept you like level-headed through it all?
I didn't even know what celebrity styling was until I was 18. Styling to me is my talent. It's my gift from God, but it's not my purpose. No matter who you are, whether you're like the upcoming rapper, I can make you look like your wildest dreams. What keeps me grounded is just the idea that I'm not there yet.
Hugo Mosier is a celebrity stylist, fashion executive, and the founder of 1116.
1116is a passion of mine because it's like no limitations. You know, I don't have to follow somebody else's mood board. You know, looking to establish a luxury fashion lifestyle brand rooted in Africa for the world.
And speaking of Diana Ross, right, she wore one of your creations at the Met Gala.
Can you imagine, like, 6 weeks before the Met Gala this year, I had zero clients?
What?
Hold on. In today's episode, we go beyond fashion. We talk about identity, cultural legacy, and what it takes to build global influence without losing your soul.
You've been the same person since I met you day one. But I'm curious, like, what is it? What's the source?
Hello, hello.
So someone's going to click into this podcast and they're going to see you. And they may be listening to this podcast on the way to work, getting ready for the morning, going to the gym. What is the one thing you want them to understand about the opportunity of fashion in Africa?
I want them to understand that fashion in Africa is not a trend, but it is a resurgence.
Okay, explain. Like, what do you mean? What is happening?
Because I feel like when you break down most of the eras of fashion and go to the root and the inspiration of it, you always find that it comes down to Black people of some sort. Like any trend, like even styles, down to like corsets and bustiers and like the way women would shape their bodies with fashion, like that literally all came back to the woman, to the Black woman's body, you know? So when it comes to African style and African fashion, I think now people are now starting to understand that it's really the root canvas to a lot of styles that we've been knowing and seeing for centuries and decades.
I love that. And so, you know, you've styled global icons and you launched cultural shifting brands and have moved across major creative capitals. But let's start at the beginning. What did it look like growing up in Nigeria and then coming to the US? Like, I really want to understand your early days.
I mean, honestly, I didn't spend too much time in Nigeria. Nigeria was the basis of my foundation and the root. You know, I was born in Enugu and I lived there for a few years, and I moved to Lagos when I was like 4, lived there for a year, and I moved to LA when I was 4 and a half. So my earliest memories of Nigeria was like very, very vague, but also substantial at the same time. You know, my earliest memories are the core of what I really just push my life by even today.
And then what did it look like coming to LA? Like, how did you even get into fashion? Because there's always this thing around parents not wanting to get us into creative industries. So it's like, you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're an engineer. So how did you even have the courage to get into this specific industry?
I think that the way my story came about, like just the way I even came into America, our circumstance, it allowed me to be able to experience the country in a whole different perspective. So like, we didn't plan to move to America. It wasn't a thing where my family was like, yo,
japa,
we're going to just japa and just go. Like, it was very much a refugee style situation. And this is a story that I have never even told before on any interview, on any sort of, you know, outlet before. Because, and it's funny because my cousin Emeka, we were speaking about something that happened in our family like back like decades ago. And I was like, yeah, that's crazy. Like, I remember that. Like, I was there. He was like, you were there? I'm like, yeah, bro, that was at my house. And he didn't even know that. Like, it was such a pivotal part of like our entire family experience. And he didn't even know that I was there at the time. But yeah, it was a situation that happened that, you know, it really shaped my entire life, like trajectory. And, you know, it was very tragic, but I had to, you know, over the course of my life, understand the triumph that comes from that tragedy. Mm. You know, I can go on to the story.
Yeah, please.
So basically, I'm gonna cut it short and just give the baseline. But basically, after an event in Nigeria, we were living in Lagos at the time, in Surulere, and my dad was working in oil and in the government, and there was like election time happening. Mm. And so pretty much we were leaving an event and we were all heading over to my house. And, you know, we were being followed like by my uncles and my cousins and just whoever else was following us to the event. I mean, following us to our house. And we get there and the first car that pulls in is like my immediate family, my mom, my dad, my sister and I. We go inside, we go upstairs. And, you know, I just recall just like time going by and my mom wondering, like, where is everybody at? Like, are they coming upstairs? And then that question escalated to hearing shouting and screaming downstairs. We can hear from over the patio downstairs and the balcony. And next thing you know, it's like gunshots. I hear my uncle screaming, like same particular words, and then gunshots. I hear the dog barking. I remember as a kid, it was one of the most significant things. I remember hearing the dog barking. And then all of a sudden, like, I hear gunshots and the dog is whimpering. Oh. And I'm like, wait, they just kill the dog? Yeah. Like, they just kill the dog just get, it was, I couldn't process it. And so literally like that happened. And one of my uncles who was down there, Uncle Nkem, I remember him just like saying like, the family is not here. No one is home. Let me take you to where they're at. Cause they were looking for my dad. Apparently he's like, let me take you to where they're at. And, you know, let's just go. They're not here. No one's here or whatever. And I remember just like the car is screeching out. And, but yeah, they ended up, like, they murdered him too. And like threw him in the gutter. They found him in the morning, but he saved our life that night. You know, like they murdered, I think like 10 people on our compound, like security guards, the drivers, the dogs, my mom's brother, my dad's cousins. Like, it was literally a massacre. And so the next week we moved to LA.
Wow.
And that's how it started. You know, like we moved to LA the next week. And I don't know if that didn't happen, if I would be sitting doing this interview today. Mm. I don't know if that didn't happen, if I would be, you know, I don't know where I would be, you know, but I had to quickly learn, you know, that I had to quickly learn that life is working for me and not to me, and understand that like every part of my life was meant to happen for the greater purpose. And this is a lesson that I learned as a kid, you know, like as a child. Yeah. So I think that, you know, when you start to process very adult situations as a child, like being the firstborn, you know, in my family and all that, and like that pressure alone and having that, I think that really just is shaped a lot. But yeah, we can get to that later on in the conversation.
I mean, thank you for being so vulnerable and sharing that. Because oddly enough, when you started talking about, I started thinking about my situation. Yours is 10x worse. But I think back in the day, there was definitely more of those type of either robberies or shootings or literally trying to gun a specific person. And, you know, I'm curious because you're here today, right, in Nigeria, and you come quite often. That hasn't scared you away. That hasn't made you afraid to even spend time, you know, here in Nigeria because of that incident that happened to your family.
Yeah, that's a great question, because, I mean, you would think that that trauma would hold such a weight that would scare me off. But I owe it to my parents, you know, even for them, you know, when I think back of what they had went through, you know, my mom had me when she was 20. And if I was 4, that means she was 24.
Yeah.
My dad was in his early 30s too. Like, that's, he was older than me. I'm older than him today than he was when that happened. Mm. So it's like understanding like that these were such young people, young adults having to process this and have children. Like, for me, like, I think that their healing process really advanced mine because I remember my dad, like, he faced it head on, you know, like, he was like, we're going to go to America, but he went right back to Nigeria. And I don't know what exactly transpired while he was there, but he was not afraid to go back and figure out what needs to happen and solve this problem. And within like 5-6 years, we came back too. And, you know, by the time I was about 12, I was going back to Nigeria every summer, you know, for the holidays. My cousins and I were rekindling, went from writing letters to actually seeing each other in person. And so I think that it was my parents, you know, if they held on to the trauma and they you know, created this like scary idea of Nigeria or Africa, I would have inherited it. But they were just like, you know, things happen. This does not reflect what this, you know, what our country is. You know, it's unfortunate, but they were going back. So I owe it to them for sure.
Ugo, did they ever find out who the perpetrators were? Was it military? Was it just robbers?
Yeah. It was military. It was military.
The military government.
Yep. They found out. And my dad and my uncles came back and they had a whole
situation.
Yeah.
So I was also born in Enugu.
Wow.
Yeah. Moved to Lagos. Amazing. As well. And then from Lagos, moved to San Francisco, not LA.
That's crazy.
But the transition for me was definitely different. But I wanted to ask specifically around your time and around that period, right? What was the adjustment like? Because I know what it was like for me to go from, I'm in Nigeria, I'm around a lot of other Black people. I don't even necessarily have a concept of race. What was that transition for you moving to LA and then integrating into the school system too?
Wow. I would say transitioning from Nigeria to LA was definitely easier than transitioning from LA to Houston, because that was my next move. And I mean, I think because of the lay of the land, right? Where I was, we were in LA, we moved to Inglewood. And I remember my school that we were at, there was like so many different cultures of people. Like, I remember being in like the ESL class, because we only spoke Igbo at home.
Really?
I had to learn English.
Really?
Really?
So I had to learn English, like, I mean, properly.
Yeah.
So, and so being in ESL class and being around all these like Asian and Indian and like other kids who are also, so it made, I didn't feel as much of an outcast.
Yeah.
So it allowed me to have a smoother young transition. It wasn't up until I was like 9, 10, 11, when I started understanding more on like racism and like, you know, the separation between African Americans and Africans.
Yeah.
Like, that was the most shocking to me. I'm like, we look alike, but y'all don't like understand, and y'all are making fun of me. Like, I don't understand. So that was a whole nother thing. But so we moved to Houston when I was around like 11, 12. Mm-hmm. And that was like a culture shock.
Mm.
Like, hence the cowboy hat. You know, it was a culture shock that I had to end up assimilating with. But like, you know, going, because LA was a place where it felt very multinational, you know, in terms of like race and people and diverse. Types of people. It was diverse. Like we were, you know, I was accepted more for being different. They're like, oh, you just whatever. Like it was okay to be different in LA. But when I moved to Houston, you know, and I was in the suburbs, this part called Sugarland, like being there, I'm like the only black kid in the class, you know, like there's two black kids in the grade.
Yeah.
I remember there was two black guys and one black girl, like in our entire grade. And to me, I was like, how? Like, this is where am I? And, you know, kids are actually wearing cowboy boots to school and cowboy hats. Like the whole, it was a shock from like culture to food to style. And, you know, for me, it was also like my introduction into like real racism, like real racism, like in the South, like
pure,
like still like blue blood racism. Like y'all still live in a plantation. You still live in the plantation that your great grandparents built and everything. Like, so that was different for me because, you know, like as an African, like we weren't introduced to the idea like, oh, black is different. Yeah. Like we were. Like my parents didn't raise me on the idea that like, because you're black, this so-and-so, or being black will lead you only this. You know, it wasn't, the race was not
never an obstruction. Even came up.
It didn't come up. Yeah. Like, we just, you know, like, I never thought that, like, I was a target to anything. But the reality was, like, you know, when you're in certain places, you are a target to certain things. Like, the cops will target you, you know, and they will stop you for no reason.
Yeah.
So I remember just, like, things like when I got my first car, I got a Jaguar when I was like 16 from my dad. It was one of his hand-me-downs, but it was a beautiful car. And I would get pulled over on the way to school at least 3 out of 5 days a week.
Whoa.
Minimum. Like I'll be late to first period at least 3 days because the cops would pull me over to ask me for, what was their favorite thing? They would say, proof of ownership. I'm like, is that even a real thing? Proof of ownership, what is that? You mean my insurance, my license? No. Like, prove that you own this car. Like, they would just say that all the time. And so to the point where I had to, like, get a different car that wasn't as loud or whatever, but it still didn't help. You're still black driving in Texas in the suburbs. Like, it's still a problem. So just, like, I think Texas was a real, it was a learning curve, but also an amazing part of my life experience because it allowed me to be aware of like the reality that exists for black people, not only in America, but it's around the world. You know, I think that, you know, obviously it's not about limiting yourself, but it's about also just being aware of the reality. You know, the awareness is not about you. Oh, now because let me not go to these places because I'm black. Like, it's not about that, but it's about being aware that sometimes you may go somewhere and they will not all love you, but that does not matter. Mm-hmm. Like that shouldn't determine like, you know, your effort or how you feel about yourself because someone in there might hate you for no reason. That's just life, you know, and that was just the lesson that I think Texas taught me. And I graduated when I was 17 and I moved to New York.
Wait, okay. So you moved to New York, right? At 17, young. So I'm curious, was there a plan? Was it vibes? You know, was there some type of structure?
How did you end up there? It was a little bit of both, vibes and plans. Because the plans didn't work, so it became vibes. It started off with some strong plans.
Okay.
It was crazy. I mean, it was, I'll try and touch on it briefly, but basically my best friends, I had two best friends.
Yeah.
Quinn and Kasim, and we all three had this like master plan of like graduating and moving to New York right away and like pursuing our dreams and all these things. And we graduated early. Well, so Quinn and I were both in high school, went to the same high school, and Kasim was in college. So Kasim was turning 21 and we were turning 18. And so the idea was like, all right, cool, we're gonna all move together. Since you're 21, you can, you know, get us
into
your apartment, you get us into places, blah, blah. And so we planned this for like 6 months, you know what I'm saying? Like where we're going to stay. I devised this whole thing, like, all right, to my parents that I got into St. John's for school, which is great. Yeah. The school I wanted to go to. But I told them that I was starting a year before I was really starting. Just so I can, I'm starting a year early. Boom, boom, boom.
So what was happening with school fees?
I told them that I was starting a year early on an internship program that allowed me to live on campus for free. Never paid nothing. I had all this figured out. I had this whole crazy plan. I was a nutcase, but I mean, it was, they believed it and they were like, this is great. Okay. Like, absolutely. Get your college credits early. The day of the trip was meant to be like Quinn and I were all ready, we're packed, we're heading to the airport with our parents, and Kasim calls and he's like, yo, I'm not gonna make it today because, you know, my parents are kind of tripping right now. I'm gonna stay a day or two and figure this out, and I'll meet y'all in New York. I'm not saying that out loud. Like, mom was like, what happened? Who's on the phone? That's Kasim. He's good. He's meeting us there. We're good. So, long story short, we end up going, and Kasim does not make it. He doesn't end up moving to New York at all. And Quinn and I had to end up figuring it out by ourselves. Ooh. You know, the first situation was the Airbnb that we got for the first 2 months. Like, we started Airbnb and then we'll get a place, boom, boom, that we got. Our first week living there, the manager of the building, she comes to the door and she's like, yo, she's like this Latin girl. She's really sweet. I thought we were cool. We had no issues. Like, and she came by. She's like, you know, you guys are really sweet guys and everything. Like, I have no issue with you. But the owner of the property came by and he said that he was mad at me because I didn't tell him that you guys were black. And he said that, you know, having two young black guys in the building brings his property value down. And people want to move in here if they see us. So we have to leave ASAP.
Oh, my God. Wow.
That's what she said, like, straight up. And I'm just like, my 18-year-old mind is processing, like, is this, like, can they do this?
Is this legal?
But at the same time, the girl, she already knew that we were 18. God, we told her that our roommate was coming in the next week. So she's already on some, like, oh, okay, like, you're here until your roommate comes anyway. So, like, we had no argument room. Like, we had no room to say anything. Like, we already shouldn't even have been there. So we were just like, okay, well, I guess that's what it is. And we moved out, like, that following Friday. And we moved into the Holiday Inn in Soho, where we spent every dime that we've ever gotten in our life in like a month.
Oh my God.
On hotel fees.
Wow. Yep.
Because at the time, did apartments not rent to 18-year-olds?
Yeah, or 17? I think you had to be 21. No.
You had to be 21.
Airbnb, so. Apartments,
yeah.
Most hotels. Like, we tried so many hotels. We tried all the cheaper ones. The only Holiday Inn on Lafayette and Soho was like, all right, you guys can come stay here. And we were paying like $100 a night. That was like our whole savings.
What year was this?
This was 2008. Yeah.
Wow.
2008.
Okay. So how do you transition out of the situation? Like, how, because obviously, like, there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Good?
Yeah.
Lord, I mean, honestly, it was always good. It was always good. For me, I was, every part of this journey was just like excitement. I'm like, I'm in New York for myself. You know, like, this being there and having like my best friends, Coco and Breezy, were also there. And we were all struggling on dollar pizza meals every day. Like, that was our meal, like dollar pizza and dollar sushi. That was like every day. And we loved it. And we were so proud and happy wearing our outfits, like, down Soho. So, like, my memory of New York, like, when I think of it as an adult, it's like, damn, that's like crazy. Like, you are a child out here in these streets, you know? But at the time, all I saw was just like freedom and opportunity for my dreams to be established. Mm-hmm. That's all I saw. And that's all we just zoned into, was just like, yo, we're here. We came this far. Like, we have our creativity, our artistry, and we're going to make it happen. So my first internship was with Virgin Records. Mm. My boy Wale was working there, and, you know, he got me in with like one of the marketing directors, and I lied that I was in college already and made a fake university recommendation and got that internship. And I was the star of the internship, you know, like to the point where like by the fourth month, I remember calling my mom. I was like complaining to her, like, my boss is so annoying. She's so lazy. She's never at work. She just gives me all the work to do, gives me all the files. I make all her phone calls. She didn't even show up no more to work. And mom was like, so she trusts you that much? She trusts you that much to just like not show up and give you all the work to do? So you should be grateful that you're learning that much, or you're on the spot. You're learning so much. You should be grateful. Mm. And next time, thank her for trusting you, because that's an amazing thing. And just that alone, I was like, oh, maybe I am pretty good. And just like, I was just soaking so much. You know, I went from interning for the marketing director at Virgin to becoming her assistant. Mm. Then I started assisting the creative director. Then everyone wanted me to work with them. I remember like my good friend now, Chris Anacote, he was like a head executive. He was managing Katy Perry. Like, he was one of the people who ushered me in also. And I got a chance to really learn about the industry, but from the inside, you know, as an A&R and a creative director in music, got a chance to learn the process from discovery to artist building and management to developing the album and the creatives, developing the artists themselves to releasing, you know, and distribution. And that was like a crash course. Mm-hmm. And then school started.
Wait, so you still went back to school? And then
school started, yes, yes. Wow. So I had a year before school started to like
soak in,
get acquainted, experience racism, get a job, get kicked out of my apartment, all those things. Like, I had a year to do all that. And then school started. And by the time school started, I'd already started interning with this stylist, Jason Rembert. Mm. So I was interning with him, and he taught me like what styling even was. He was like, you're fresh, like, you know, boom. And he knew that I had interest in fashion. So he just like brought me on and taught me the ropes. And literally after about 6 months working with him, I got my first client. It was Don Richard at the time from Danny DeCane and Dirty Money. Like,
what? That was your first client?
First client, 18 years old. She was like, come with me, you're good. And we just like started working together, traveling the world together. And she really just like gave me the first affirmation that I needed to know that I can do this. You know, from there, it was Khalees and Tiana Taylor and Omarion. And then I worked with Patricia Fields on Sex and the City, the movie. And this is like all before I turned 20. You know, I was already in the space. I remember when I first moved to New York, the dream was like, yo, to be like June Ambrose's assistant. Mm-hmm. That was like everyone's dream as a fashion. If you're Black and wanted to get into fashion, like that was June like Ambrose, the job.
Yes.
Working for June Ambrose, like that's like, that was it. She was like the Rachel Zoe. And, you know, I remember like I applied for the internship and I didn't get it. But by the time I left New York, like she knew who I was as a stylist, you know, and I thought that like, for me, that was like such a beautiful thing. Like just her acknowledging my work as being good, you know, like that was like my first like just little affirmation, you know, mm-hmm. from someone that you look up to. Like, it goes a long way, you know, in your journey when you have like those benchmarks of like positive feedback, you know. And So from New York, I moved to Paris for a year.
And then tell us about that journey. Like, was that, would you say, a pivotal moment for you in fashion, or did you still have way more lessons you had to learn?
After New York?
Yeah.
I would say after New York, I mean, the lessons, just it just got started. You know, New York to me was like, I would say New York was middle school. Mm-hmm. That was middle school. You know, it's like the struggles of like finding yourself and like becoming who you are in this space with all these opportunities and distractions. And then for me, Paris was high school, because high school is where you actually start learning things that you might actually apply to your life. So this is where I learned about the fashion industry. You know, I built my network in fashion, you know, working as a editor of this magazine called Goobar. My friend Sarah Doof was the owner and editor. She brought me in, and this was like my first opportunities, like styling editorials and like booking talent for editorials and deciding the creative and producing the creatives. And so I got an opportunity to really just build my network in fashion from the like center of it. You know, like I got a chance to develop strong relationships with, you know, Olivier Balmain and like, you know, Ricardo and just literally all the brands in Paris. Like, cause I was this like 20-year-old, 19-year-old kid, like in fashion, like fearless in my style, like fearless in my approach. It was attractive. People wanted to know, like, wanted to like know me and work with me. And I became a magnet, you know, at an early age. Like I became a magnet for champions. I became a magnet for people who are the best of the best in their field. Like I feel like a filter came over me after Paris. Like I realized not only like my worth, but I also realized like my impact on what like my touch can do to people, like from the outside, from the inside out. And so after a year in Paris, I moved to LA where I can go and start exercising that touch, that magic wand a little bit.
Yeah. And actually, before we move into your chapter in LA, how was Paris for you? Did you experience racism? And the reason why I speak about this is so many people, Black people, talk about their difficulty entering Paris fashion, right? So New York, they can dominate. LA, they can dominate. When they now start going to the European houses, there seems to be a bit of tension. So did you experience any of that, or at least you see it still in the current fashion world?
I would say like fashion in general is definitely probably the most like blatant racist industry. Like it's an industry where you're allowed to say like, we don't want Black girls for this season. You know, you can say that I don't want a Black guy for this shoot. You can say that. It's okay. If creatively your aesthetic is not a Black girl, you can shoot a white girl. It's your choice. You know, you can't say that in the workplace and, you know, on Wall Street. You can't say that in Fortune 500. You can't say that. But fashion gives you the freedom to be as exclusive and as racist as you want to be, you know? And I think with that being said, like with Paris being the epitome of it, like it's the highest level of it, you're going to find it more prevalent there than most places. Also for me, what I discovered very early when it comes to like the industry is you're only as important as who your clients are. That's really it. You can be the most talented person in the world and have the coolest, dopest aesthetic, but if your clients don't matter, like aren't currently relevant, then that's your currency. So going into Paris, luckily, like I always had access to people that they considered valuable, you know, coming in there with Sarah, thank God, in this magazine, you know, we were shooting like Tiana and I brought Dawn for a shoot. I'm bringing in like my talent for shoots. So Paris, like they're valuing that. They're like, okay, like you have something that we need. So I always knew how to leverage that. When I come to Paris, I'm always coming with something. Mm. I'm not coming there empty handed. Mm. Lav came there with the top of the top of the top people, like the most influential people in the world mm-hmm. I've brought in there. So like they know that, like, you know, that the value that I bring to that place, but that does not excuse the fact that it is very damn racist. It's very damn racist. But again, that's just the industry, you mm-hmm. know, that I chose to be in. You know, I knew that I was entering an industry that was built on the opinions of others. Like fashion is built on opinions. Mm. That's why like I'm not sitting here taking anything too seriously. Like you have the right to hate what I have on. Mm. Like you have the right to say it looks horrible and somebody else has spent 10K on it. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? That's the industry that we're on. You know, it's built on people's opinions. So like it's not for the lighthearted. You know, if it's not people who can't handle criticism, it's not about that. It's like you have to be fearless in what you create and fearless in who you are.
And I want to talk about, you've styled everyone, right? And I want you to walk us through the emotional weight behind a moment like Justin's Met Gala look, right?
Justin Bieber.
And what we didn't see behind those headlines.
That was a moment for sure. A moment like Justin's Met Gala look, I would say, you know, we see the end product and we see the look, but something like that takes like almost a year to manifest and to like to culture and nurture and establish and make happen. You know, at the time, Olivier and I were really good friends. We just spent like an amazing New Year in Dubai together, just like one of my favorite New Years ever. And, you know, during that trip, we were just speaking about working together and opportunities. And I just put that bug in his ear, like, yo, like, what do you think about Justin coming with Balmain to the Met? And he was just like, I don't know. Like that's an interesting idea. And but that's where the seed was sown. And you know, for me, like I had to like, you know, go to Paris and like nurture the idea, introduce the idea, take him to lunch, show him some ideas. And like by the time I knew it, he was like, yeah, let's do it. And you know, we had about 3 months to make the look. Like every hand beaded gold applique, gold Swarovski we put on there was just made with so much love. And that's why the moment like came out the way it was. Like when you think about very special moments, there's always a special story behind it. Even if it was like, oh, we just decided to do this today, but there's a story behind it to make it special. And that's what, you know, I love most about my job is that every experience, you know, every job is just so unique. Yeah. You know, it's so unique. It's a career where every job feels like we have a whole new job every time. You know, it's like these interviews. It's like it's an interview, but with each person you're speaking to, it's like a whole nother experience that we're engulfing. I think that's like the most special part.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to kind of even go backwards, like what moments did you have to go through to get to Justin Bieber? Like, would you say that was your first like pivotal client, or would you say there was someone else that kind of like really put you out in the stratosphere? Like you're getting known, people know you, they understand your style. But what was that client that like, they're like, oh, okay, he's that.
Okay. I would say my first pivotal client was Chris Brown. Mm. That was my first client when I moved to LA. And, you know, him and I had such a dynamic bond and understanding and synergy when it came to clothes and fashion. You know, I understood his style to the point where it's like, we didn't even need fittings. Like, I'll send you the outfit. And that's what you go wear. Like, it was such a great synergy. But he allowed me to really, like, showcase, like, my aesthetic, you know, showcase, like, my, just flex my muscles in fashion. Because, you know, him being such a fearless, like, perfectly built muse, it allowed me to just, like, create beautiful moments. And for him, he trusted me. I trusted him. And I think the world just was able to see, like, great things happen through that. You know, we told stories through the look. It was at a time when, you know, everything was just very sensitive. You know, a lot of people were sensitive to things that were being said. So fashion was our outlet, you know, to storytell and to show, you know, who he is as an artist. And yeah, that was great.
Ugo, you've operated at the intersection of fashion, tech, and media. What systems do you believe African creatives must build to sustain power, not just visibility?
I would say that, you know, whether your outlet or career is in tech, you know, entertainment, media, fashion, music, the most important system to have in place is a trusted team and the right partnerships and collaborations. I feel like Africans in general, like across the board, have had to, you know, for a long time fend for themselves, you know, and we're forced to create our lives for ourselves, by ourselves, like this, like, you know, every man for themselves mentality, whether it's like, you know, through war or through just like different traumatic situations that brought this mindset to us. I think that our strength and like the journey towards healing will go into us just like understanding the power of unity. And unity goes across the board. It's the unity in the workspace. You know, it's unity in the friendships. It's unity in relationships. It's about really building, working together. I think that, you know, that's what I think is my biggest strength in my career, is the ability to know like who to bring on and also trusting them. You know, I have such an amazing team in Nigeria, in America, in Europe, of people that I've worked with for like for almost a decade now that are part of my team. But, you know, it like this, the core of it is trust and loyalty. And it starts with me. I think that a lot of, you know, people, a lot of executives and founders and owners, I have really deep rooted trust issues. And when you're running an operation with trust issues, there's already holes all over it. People know you when you don't trust them. People know that, you know, and it's like, no, and people associate trust to value. And when people feel disvalued or undervalued in any space, it affects their output. Like, you can't put out the best of your ability in a space where you don't feel like you're ultimately valued. So that's the thing that, you know, I keep it in mind when operating, you know, all of my, you know, companies across the board, is making sure that I'm hiring and bringing people on the board that I actually truly trust, that are the best in their field, in their game, where I can give them that freedom to operate and to move and to create, you know, on their highest level.
So for some of our viewers, right, who are looking to learn about, you know, the fashion opportunities that exist on the continent, right, what are some of the infrastructure challenges that exist behind the scenes, right? Like, navigating that, comparing it between maybe what you've seen abroad versus on the continent.
Okay. For people that are looking to venture into the fashion space here, you know, whether it's like starting your own business, or just learning more, I think the main challenge that you will see, that I see, goes into quality control. Mm-hmm. You know, when wanting to create a business and you need like multiples of things, you need hundreds of things, thousands of things. It's like that quality control, making sure that everything is attended to with the right amount of attention as the ones that were when you were in the building watching them. Yeah. You know, that's the biggest thing that I find as a challenge. But again, it goes down to patience and training. Cause like, you know, I have my team of seamstresses and tailors and pattern makers that make like everything I wear. And, you know, it wasn't an overnight thing. You know, it took like these guys have been with me for like 10 years.
Yeah. Really?
Like, yeah. Like I have Olaz 10 years in the game. Lacon's 10 years in the game. Daniel and ID are 7 years. So it's like the youngest one is maybe 3 years,
yeah.
You know, right now, but we've been auditioning. We're trying to grow, but it's hard. You know, I understand it's difficult because people, you know, out here are very impatient. They're very, very impatient with everything across the board, you know, on every level of society, it has impatience. And when you have an impatient society, it's hard to establish like fine details in craftsmanship, mm-hmm. unless it's like someone who's an artist, mm-hmm. who's a painter, or someone who's passionate about it. But when it comes to like, you know, normal day-to-day service jobs and things of that sort, like you have to be patient and trained. You know, for me, I knew that in order for me to create the system that I needed to be in place, I had to, it wasn't a one day trip. Mm-hmm. Like you guys see me here every other month,
yep.
if not every month, but this is what it takes to be able to establish here. You know, I think people have a misconception like, oh, I'm going to Nigeria. That's where the money is. Like Africa is where the money is. I'm going to go there and rack up. And like, you know, they think that it's a place you just go and just like, with the money back and just start stacking and then go back to America with money. Yeah. It's like, that's not how it works. Yeah. Like nobody is opening the floodgates to money to you if they know that you're not here to stay.
Yeah.
Like I think the enemy of business is like Japa here. Like you can't, like if any executive or whatever thinks that, you know, they want to see that you've proven the loyalty to here,
yeah.
mm-hmm. you know, before they're really going to give you that contract that's like sustaining and all these things, right? Like you have to, like they know. And it's like a lot of trauma also from being exploited.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, people have exploited the continent since God knows when.
Yeah.
And I think that like it's not only just white people exploiting, it's everyone exploiting.
Yeah.
Like even Nigerians are exploiting. I think that if you're a African that has the mindset of coming to gain money and financial reward out of Africa to go and like, oh, spend and live in like Michigan, wherever you are, you're exploiting too.
Yeah. Mm. 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 And actually, you know, I didn't even realize that you've been, you know, working with your team here for 10 years. So what made you say, I want to invest in like building out a team here outside of your outfit in US and in Europe? What did you see?
Honestly, I saw that people here were way more efficient, ready to work, ready to learn, and ready to build. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm like, And it was cheaper. So it's like, I can do all this in LA or in New York, or I can do it here where I'm providing actual jobs, you know, and opportunities for my people. Mm-hmm. It was a no-brainer. You know, once I understood like one, like the cost and the value chain of producing everything here, it was a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. You know, like I still collaborate and make things in Italy and in LA, but I must say like 95% of what I create, like things I make custom for my clients, you know, were all made here in Lagos.
Can you walk us through that? Cause recently I saw this amazing cowboy belt that you wore, right? And it was, you said it was a collaboration, you know, with Winston Leather, right? And it was all made here, correct? Like, can you talk about that? Because I think
there's a huge misconception that you can't get those type of materials here in Nigeria and that you have to go somewhere and then import it and then finally someone can make it here.
That's a huge misconception because, I mean, there's not much that I cannot find on the continent, you know, whether it's Nigeria, but on the continent for sure. That belt, I actually made it like 3 years ago. Mm. I made the belt a while ago. And that was my first time wearing it was last week.
Really?
Like I tend to just make things and just keep it. Like, if I have an idea, and that's the beauty of Nigeria. Because here's one of the only places where I can just be like, I want to make a Benin bronze championship belt made out of crocodile in 1 week. And I went there to the market, got my Benin bronzes, went to Benin, picked them up, went into Winston. And so Winston, his family owned Winston Leather. And they're like one of the oldest leather production houses in Africa. Mm. They're based in Kano. And they source leather for like LVMH, like Kering Group. Like, majority of leathers you see in Italy are literally coming from here. And they're refining and dyeing in Italy from Winston. So it was important for me to just like to work with him. I think like he won his... The company itself deserve recognition for what they've done. You know what they do. Like the European brands have done so much to like erase their involvement in this chain, which is like the source. Like how you erase the source's involvement. You know. So for me, it was just important to involve him and like credit them. Let people know like, yo, we have the finest like leathers and the finest, you know, animal skins. And what I love about him especially is like their skins and leathers are ethically sourced. Mm. So the animals are not killed for skin, but they use animals that were killed to be eaten. Mm. So the skins are like the parts of the animals that, you know, are left over after the meal, after it's cooked. So the entire animals are sustainable. You know, there's no, they're not. And it's like, it's all repurposed leathers and skins. So yeah, it's dope.
And I also want you to talk about, I feel like you are always been authentic to yourself, authentic to your storytelling and even through your style, right? And how do you balance that through meeting up with industry expectations, right? So what the industry expects you or your clients to look like, but also staying authentic to yourself. How do you balance the two?
Honestly, I've never had a choice. Mm-hmm. I think that authenticity to myself has always been on the forefront in my style and fashion and moving. You know, I remember like being a kid, like in Houston and, you know, like me rebelling against the cowboy fits for a few years and keeping my Hawaiian shirts on and my skinny jeans, my skater jeans on like that. Like it was, you know, I was never afraid to be the only one doing something, and doing that ended up always rewarding me in some way.
Yeah.
Like I ended up becoming like known as like the fashion kid, like, oh, this, you know, Ugo, like he's always going to put that shit on. And like, and it was just me being myself. Like I wasn't intentionally trying to like, you know, be anything other than just like wear what I like wanted to wear.
Yeah.
And that itself, like, you know, put me in a position of like, you know, admiration or aspiration because I was like fearless with that. So when I moved to New York, like it was even more affirmation because it was like people were just coming up to me all the time for, you know, tips and like, you know, what I wanted to wear. And working at Virgin, you know, in the creative space, like they were never like not talking about like, oh, what's Ugo's look for today? You know, and I think that, you know, when I was, you know, being praised, I guess, for being yourself, you know, at an early age will just build that muscle. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it's an exercise that some people get a chance to experience at different like parts of their life, you know, and I think the earlier the better, you know, and luckily I got a chance to experience it early where I was, you know, like praised and accoladed for my, for what I would do right, you know, and just being 18 also, mm-hmm. like working with like celebrity clients who are like trusting me to dress them for like the Grammy Awards and like, you know, things like that. I think that that responsibility just allowed me to really just tap in and own it early.
Yeah. And speaking on that of you being authentic to yourself. So you've been dressing clients for a long time, right? And I now see you stepping into your own personal brand, right? Including these pieces that I really enjoy looking at because I know they are coming out from here, right? Can you talk about your brand? What's inspiring it? And what do you see it, the future of it?
Yes, I can. yeah, this is 1116 is it's a passion of mine. You know, I feel like it's like my life's work because mm-hmm. when it comes to designing, it's what I've always done. You know, whether it's collaborating with other brands, you know, or consulting with other brands, but designing has always been the root of my creation. So to be able to, you know, now focus on designing my own brand and collection and just being able to tell my entire story through clothing is very special because it's like no limitations. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have to follow somebody else's mood board, you know, and have to accommodate somebody else's vision with mine, which has been great, you know, and allowed me to practice, mm-hmm. you know, the art of collaboration. But, you know, now it's like, it really feels like it's my time. And I'm just so blessed with the amount of people, mm-hmm. you know, that are giving me the opportunity to show it. You know, I couldn't even dream of like Diana Ross being
yeah, we gotta talk about
my
that.
First like muse mm-hmm. ever. Like, you know, before I even launched my brand, you know, she's telling me that, you know, like you're the designer that I want to wow. design for me. Like just those kind of experiences just let me know that, okay, I am doing it. I'm doing what I need to do at the right time. Like, you know, just those affirmations make it all worth it.
Mm. And speaking of Diana Ross, right? She wore one of your creations at the Met Gala. Can you, first of all, that whole, it was iconic. Let's be honest. It felt like she started the show. She started the show, she ended the show. So everyone just had to kind of measure up to that look. Can you talk about that and even just, you know, what this current Met Gala of Black dandyism, what did it mean to you to like have, you had so many looks and so many collaborations. So I would love to talk through those different pieces.
Yeah, so this Met Gala was very fun.
Yeah.
To say the least. It was a time. I got a chance to wear two hats, you know, as a designer and also as a stylist. And I wanted to wear both hats, like, and literally make it into a space suit. You know, I turned that hat. I wanted to take it all the way to space. You know, I was just so pumped up. Can you imagine, like, 6 weeks before the Met Gala this year, I had zero clients?
What?
What? Hold on. Okay, what do you mean? What does that mean? You had no idea.
I had no idea. Like, everything happened literally within 2 months of the Met Gala. Mm. You know, there was a client that I had been working on for like over a year. You know the process. Mm-hmm. I told you the courting process, going to see the designers, having these meetings, taking them to lunch. And, you know, I thought that it was like the most amazing thing. I thought that I came up with the most epic like collaboration. I was just, this is going to beat the Bieber moment. Like, this is going to be the moment. And literally 2 months before the Met Gala, the client decides he wants to go in another direction and hire another stylist.
I feel like I knew who the client is.
And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And the thing is, like usually, I don't know, like usually when something so abrupt and sudden and random happens, like as human beings, like the first initial thought was like, wait, what? Like shock or like, I don't know, anger or, you know, disappointment. But my immediate reflex reaction was gratitude. Mm. I was like, okay, this is a sign. This gotta be God. Cause ain't no way I put all that effort in for ain't no way. So like my immediate reaction was like, oh, something's coming. Mm. Something's coming. I knew right away that God was clearing the way for something. Mm. And I immediately went into praise and worship.
Wow.
I was just like, yo, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening, but I'm so grateful and I'm so thankful. Like, thank you, God, for whatever is coming, whatever opportunity you have coming my way. I don't know what it is, but I feel it and I receive it and I accept it. Like, that was it. And then I call my manager. I'm like, girl, what happened? What's going on? And she was like, you know what? She's like, I really don't feel like we lost anything. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, me too. I feel like we actually just, I feel a gain. She's like, do you feel a sense of gain? She's like, I feel like we just gained the world. Like, mm-hmm. So I don't know what, we had the same feeling. And literally, I remember it was like 3 days later, I got the call from boss. They were like, yo, we want you to dress our talent for the show. We love working with you. Are you down to like, you know, do the Met with us? And they had like 5 clients. I was like, okay, well, I don't like, this is like crazy. Like, absolutely. And a day later, I get a phone call from Beyonce's team at Parkwood, you know, saying they want me to work on some tour designs for her and Blue. And I'm just like, what? What? And then a few days later, I want to say maybe 2-3 days later, I get the phone call from Evan and Diana saying that they want me to dress her for the Met Gala. And I'm just like, and this is all within 1 week of getting that, you know, getting that phone call. And like right away, I was like, God is so real. Like, God is just so beyond phenomenally real. And that moment, again, just like changed my life forever. And it wasn't the rewards mm-hmm. that came in, mm-hmm. but it was like the reaction.
Yeah.
Mm.
The reaction to that phone call, right, to that message. Like, I realized, like, when we say everything's happening for you and not to you, everything's happening for you. Mm. And I'm like, oh, the sooner you tap in to the gratitude yep. of disappointment or rejection, the sooner the reward comes.
Ooh. That's a quote.
Hey, that's a quote. Bible verse right there.
It's true. Like, you know, we can sit there and be sad about mm-hmm. it for however long we want. Because mm-hmm. what is time? Mm-hmm. You can be sad for 2 minutes or 6 months. Mm. I've seen people sad for 6 months. Yeah. That's a long time to be sad about something. I mean, obviously we're human beings, yeah. but at the end of the day, we have to tap in mm. to the idea of glass half full. Mm-hmm. The idea of everything is working mm. for you. Mm. The idea that you are on the path that you need to be on. Mm. You know, as soon as you start feeling like, damn, why is God, like, why isn't, those questions are disloyalty mm-hmm. to God. Mm-hmm. And those questions, like I feel like prolong whatever you're asking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're putting these timelines mm-hmm. and guidelines and questioning to, you know, to your to your dreams or your request or your purpose, mm-hmm. you're prolonging it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's really about just enjoying the journey, you know, mm-hmm. doing the best you can yeah. every single day, you know, outputting on your maximum effort every single day and just trusting mm-hmm. that God will reward you accordingly mm-hmm. when it's time.
Yo, I got questions. I'm putting down the formal questions. Personal questions. Because you know, I think one thing I've observed about you, I know Nigerians, right? If they even just mentioned one of the names you've mentioned, just one, right? Their shoulder would be so high, they could never come down, right? But you walk around with a certain humility and groundedness. I also see you surrounded with a lot of family, right? You seem very like
you're always grounded with family
in that, right? So I wanted to understand the Ugo we're talking to today could not have been the same Ugo at 18 in New York, right? Like the mindset has shifted, the energy has shifted. What did you have to unlearn? And what did you have to embrace, right? And what were the tools that helped to shape the man we're sitting next to right now?
What did I have to unlearn and
what embrace? Did you have to embrace? Yeah.
I had to definitely unlearn the energy of letting everyone in. Mm-hmm. I think that my parents, they had this like open door policy kind of vibe growing up where there was always a cousin or auntie and uncle. Someone's always at the house multiple at the same time. And I think for a while, it really hindered me when it came to like business and friendship because I would trust people too fast. Like, you know, there's a certain level of trust. Like there's levels to trust.
Yeah.
I think I'll go from like 0 to like 8. And like by day 2, you move in, come to the crib. I got a couch for you. Yeah. And that was like a lot of my 20s, which is me being so trusting and just so open to people and energies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learned protecting my peace, you know, later in my 20s, early 30s, I learned the importance of protecting my ground because again, it's like, it's so fragile, you know, like life is such a fragile thing and place. Like it's not for everyone to experience with us at every time. And I think it's important to know and to accept the fact that, you know, people should be compartmentalized, you know, whether it's a chapter or eras or times or places. Like I had to learn that not everyone is meant to come with you to every step on every chapter, and it's fine.
Yeah.
It's not beef, it's not animosity, it's just time and it's fine.
You've helped pioneer African luxury visibility. What's next for African fashion on the global stage, and what's at risk if we don't control the narrative?
I would say what's next for African fashion on a global stage is the world having more accessibility to the brands and the vendors and the designers. For such a long time, there was like, you know, there's like it's not easy to get African clothes when you're in the States.
Yeah. No.
Like it's not at all. Like even for me, who's like in my industry, I remember when it was like, whenever there's like, you know, Black Panther or like, you know, one of these Lion King or movies, like they're all running to me for African clothes. I'm like, I don't have any. Like, I have the abada just hanging around. Like, it's not something we have access to, even beyond abadas, but even just like
the fabrics
and the designers and like, you know, past like the normal dashikis we see like in the, you know, the flea markets and stuff. Like there's no access. So I feel like that's the that is the next step right now that's being filled, even with like, you know, online shopping and like different platforms that are having, you know, they're bringing in multi-label designers on their platform. Like it's happening. So by the time we know it, you know, the average Susie from Idaho can order, you know, her Benki Cuckoo too online and get shipped there right away.
Yeah.
Or it's, you know, I'm seeing that, you know, even like Amazon, you know, places like that are coming out here and, you know, connecting with more African designers, you know. So imagine when you see African brands on Amazon and like, you know, on Farfetch and on those sites, I think that's the next step, is really just the visibility and opportunity.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm curious, with your clients, do they ask for African brands? Like, are they seeking it? Are you noticing that shift?
With my clients, like, they some of them are. Like Stevie Wonder, for example, he was very much like adamant and excited about just like African brands, African design. It was very intentional. But I think for the most part, like when talent hire me, they sort of expect it. Like they hire me because they know that I'm going to introduce them to some new brands or vibes they don't know. You know, like you'll see the Valentinos and things there, but you'll also see things you've never seen before in your entire life. You know, I think that that's like what I've been able to position myself as. Like, that's like what separates me from everyone else, is the fact that like when I come into the picture, it's beyond just like the hottest trend or fashion or the runway, but I'm bringing in a strong sense of culture into the entire look.
What did you notice about this year's 2025 Met Gala that could signal a deeper shift in fashion or culture?
I noticed in this 2025 Met Gala that it is possible for Black designers, African designers to be worn and positioned on huge main stages. I think that for a while people associate, you know, like designers and brands of color as like a little less than, you know, like I'll wear you guys to like the brunches, but I'll wear Gucci to the Oscars. You know, like I'll wear you guys to like, you know, the smaller events, but I'll wear like Valentino to like the Grammys. And I think that what this established this year was showing just the possibilities of what African brands, what Black brands can do, like how chic and how lush they can. I think now there's no excuse on why we won't be seeing more, you know, designers of color on other big red carpets, like not limiting, waiting for another, you know, Black inspired theme to bring in Black designers. I think that this is really just like broke that mold to where like, you know, everyone, like non-Black people can feel like they have permission now to support and wear Black and African designers.
When you see shows or award shows like the AMVCA and the fits that they come through, I remember being in the US and I did it for music. So I became a promoter for the music and Afrobeat side of things. So I would be hearing this music early and trying to convince your friends who maybe might be white or Black or whoever, like, yo, this shit is dope. Right. Now, when I see the fashion, right? So that was my own like entry point for a cultural perspective, right? I always wonder where you look at a Met Gala like pre this year with a Black theme, and then you look at the AMVCA and you're like, look, if you asked an alien and they landed on the earth and they didn't know nothing about each society or any like racism or media narratives, which is doper here? It would be like, yo, this is it right here, right? So
that's a good
it's a good analogy, right? And it tells me that our taste is global. It's always been global. We didn't even need any validation for that. But when you see stuff like that, what does that like invoke in you? Like, what do you think about the whole thing where it's like, look, our stuff is world-class dope. Like, this is not good for Africa, good for Nigeria. This is great.
Just honestly, being in New York during the Met Gala while all that was happening, and I also had like a couple of clients at AMVCA at the same time, and just seeing the dynamic of what was coming from there and what we put up at the same time. It was so amazing. I don't know what, like at the time it was like, I don't know what was more lit. I'm like, y'all are coming through with the looks back to back. It was so amazing and inspiring. I think that it was, for me, one of the most inspiring weekends because of that. Seeing AMVCA. And the Met Ball, just like the amount of just like media coverage coming out of both was insane. And it just gave me another, like, I was like, yeah, I was just like, this has to be like, we have to do something.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I've been talking about and, you know, putting together the idea of like a fashion awards, you know, for years. But after that, I'm like, oh, it has to happen.
Yeah.
Because, like, one, these designers work so hard.
Yeah.
They work too hard to not be recognized and awarded for that, right? Like, I'm like, they need to be supported. They need to be highlighted on a global scale. Like, I'm watching the BTS videos and I'm like seeing all the weeks of hand. This is couture.
Yeah.
There's no difference between this and what they're doing at Valentino and at Versace and at Dolce and at Schiaparelli. There's no difference. If not, this might even be better. It's more creative. Like, cause these people are creating out of like the theme itself. Like, I remember it was like a garden, jungle or something theme. Like, they're literally making clothes out of like the jungle theme. And when I tell you, like, they're making epic, beautiful, amazing gowns, but that's like the level of creativity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the Met Gala was inspired by a style of clothing that you can reference and see, like, the style of clothing. AMVC was referencing the garden, like the garden, like that's creative. Like what, how you gonna make the garden into your outfit? Like, that's so epic. And I think that, like, we, it's time. Like, I want to use my network, my platform. I want to use my resources to create like the African Fashion Awards here that can really just like highlight and showcase, because AMVCA is a film event.
Yeah.
First of all, it's a film event. Like, and they're going that hard. So imagine when we give them an actual fashion show. So it's time. That's coming next year.
Okay, you heard it here first. But actually, another thing I want to talk about with your brand specifically, what does it look like in a few years, right? Is it a physical location? Is it, you know, ongoing experiences? Are you stepping away from styling? Like, what does that look like?
So with the brand 1116, I am, you know, looking to establish a luxury fashion lifestyle brand rooted in Africa for the world. Mm-hmm. You know, our fashion house is going to be in Lagos. Mm-hmm. We're going to open our first boutique in Lagos. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to expand to the States and to the year into Europe. But we're really focusing really on our D2C, our customer experience, you know, and creating our world and allowing, cause it's right now, the most important thing is really education for us. You know, we're using, it's fashion and it's clothing, it's glitz and it's glam, but it's really education.
Yeah.
You know, when you see that the Benin bronze belt that I wore, yeah, it was a super dope look and everything, but when you read the caption, you've learned about Benin bronzes. Yeah. You learn about the history. You know, like, you know, the significance of what that means. It's beyond just like bling bling. It's deeper than that. And that's what we were looking to do with our brand, is, you know, through each collection, through each, you know, each chapter, each era, be a way to educate the world on us, you know, on our creativity, on our magnitude, on our power. You know, it's like when I think about like the Met Gala again, circle back to that, like the theme was dandyism. And it came from, you know, this book that was titled like Slaves to Fashion. And it really explored fashion post-slavery. Like, how did Black people dress after they were free from slavery? You know, and just like, again, like, that's not a story that I personally like I can pull from and be creative from. So that's why it's like, it's, you know, but I do understand that it's a lot of people's story.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of people that can relate and understand that and pull from that. And that is the root of a lot of Black people's style. You know, it does root and cap there. So for me, I feel like it's my duty to break that ceiling of like our fashion and style just coming from like after slavery.
Yeah.
What are you going to tell Mansa Musa about what he wore? What are you going to tell Cleopatra about what she wore? You know what I'm saying? Like we are people that like we taught them how to dress. We taught them how to bathe and shower and clean and all these things. And so I think it's like just the idea of, you know, just taking power within, you know, our story, but using fashion as a vehicle.
Yeah. And what does legacy look like for you?
Legacy is so important to me. You know, legacy is what I do this for. You know, it's my family I have now, my future family. You know, it is about what I'm leaving on this earth. Besides, like, you know, a dope story. He came, he was so nice and he did his thing. He wore fly outfits. But it's like, what, like, how are children in 200 years going to benefit because of what I left on this earth today? You know, when you're a music student and you're studying Mozart and Shakespeare and you know, and Beethoven, like they left something for a generation to study and look back on. That's legacy to me. You know, when you're in a British theater or in Broadway and you're using Shakespeare as like a tool to sharpen your acting and your writing, like Shakespeare left a legacy. That's a legacy for me. So like when I think of legacy, it's like, what am I leaving on this earth in this timeline that 400 years from now, they can look back and be like, okay, they're learning. You know, I want to leave tools for education that people can see what I did. And, you know, not only is it going to affect and change the world today, but it's going to sustain and continue helping, you know, for the future as well.
I love it. So rapid fire is where we ask you question, you can give yes, no, or just give the first thought that pops into your head, right? So the first question is Lagos or LA?
Lagos.
Okay.
You didn't even hesitate. It was like,
I love my two LAs, but Lagos is holding it right now.
Okay.
Most meaningful gift you've ever received?
The most meaningful gift I've ever received was permission from my parents at an early age.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love it.
They allowed me to be. And that's something that a lot of, I would say a lot of ethnic children can't relate to is that. And that gift alone really just shaped everything for me, knowing that my parents are supporting my wildest ideas at the age of 12.
Yeah.
Like that really allowed me to know that anything is possible.
I love that. One designer who deeply inspires you, dead or alive?
One designer that deeply has inspired me a lot, I would say, is Michael Bush. Michael was Michael Jackson's costume designer.
Okay.
And he was responsible for like all the moments. Like the Thriller jacket, like the Smooth Criminal bending shoes.
Wow.
Like he really defied like just fashion with Michael. And like even today, whenever I'm like dressing up, it's like, what would Michael do? How would Michael do it? And yeah, so I think Michael is the epitome of striving your hardest, of putting in your best effort, no matter what it is. Like it's like there's like only a few Michaels and Beyoncés and Princes that are people that are like, when they do it, it's all or nothing.
What's a Met Gala dream theme for you?
A Met Gala dream theme for me would be African royalty.
It's coming.
That's it.
It's coming.
Why don't we do it this year? Why don't we just call it African royalty? That's what I chose. I don't know if you peeped that, but that's what we are doing.
A ritual you swear by before every major project?
It would definitely be like a prayer and fasting. I go into prayer and fasting before any major project. It's important to me to really just like hand it over. Like it's my handing over process. Like when I know that I've done, I've put in all my efforts, you know, it's like I hand it over.
What's one story from your journey that people don't know but should?
I would say was the first story that I told.
Yes.
That's a, I mean,
definitely.
It's the foundation of a lot of things. And yeah, it's like the core of my life.
Mm. Well, let me ask you, this is now a personal question for me. Going back to my original point, you've met quite a few people. Like I said, I know Nigerians. Just one of those names, Chris Brown, Beyonce, Diana Ross. You could not even breathe next to these niggas. You feel me? What has kept you like level-headed through it all? Like what sort of like coach you to even be like that? Because you don't seem like you shift, whether it's like Beyonce or whether it's like the next person, Joe Smo down the street. Like you seem pretty like grounded. So what has led to that?
Hey, wait, can I add a layer? Because you've been the same person since I met you day one. You have to shift it. I mean, you already were doing your thing beforehand, but it's actually mind blowing because there's people who've done nothing and they'll act like, why are you in my air? so it's actually just inspiring. Like it keeps me grounded just seeing how you operate. But I'm curious, like, what is it? What's the source? What's the sauce?
I would say that I didn't dream of being the biggest stylist in the world. Like I didn't dream of like, I didn't even know what celebrity styling wasn't until I was 18. Mm. I didn't know it was a job that existed, you know? And there were situations in my life, like when I was the PR director of Vivian Westwood, like I was operating on the highest level of fashion PR, like running this company's marketing and branding. I was 23 years old, the youngest PR director in fashion. And even at the time, it was like, I just felt very numb. Cause I'm like, this is great. This is a dream job. But it's not my dream job. Mm. Like it's not my dream job. So there was always like still something missing. Mm. Like even like, you know, every step of the way, like being 18 and 19, having these celebrity clients, like my friends were still in school, in high school, you know? And even then I was like, this is dope, but like, this is not what I really like set out to do. Like it has never felt like my dream accomplishment, you know? And then coming to LA and like styling and like, you know, working with the biggest artists in the world, like, you know, in the globe. And even with that, it feels like styling to me is my talent and it's my gift from God, but it's not my purpose. You know, it's not what I was set out here to do and launch. It's a tool. You know, I have the ability to make people elevate. You know, I can elevate people from the inside using tools from the outside. I can make you feel like your higher self when I put you in this garment and this regalia. And that's a gift. And I know that like, in order for God to keep blessing me and leading me towards like that path where I am going, I have to exercise the gift. You know, I cannot put the gift aside because it's like, it's a superpower. Like I know what, no matter who you are, you know, whether you're like, you know, the upcoming rapper or you're Diana Ross, like I can make you look like your wildest dreams, you know, and that's like the gift that I have. And even when I go through these times, I'm like, oh, I'm so over styling. I'm so over these hoes. Like, like there's always something like God is like, no, you're not. Take your ass right back. Like Stevie's calling. Yeah. You don't say no to Stevie Wonder? Really? Really? So, and you know, but ultimately I think that what, to answer the question, what keeps me grounded is just the idea that I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm like, this is all great. Mm. I'm so, so, so grateful for every step, everyone, but I'm not there yet. Mm. You know, I know that there's people out there in this world who dreams like every night of their Met Gala moment, like it's their wedding day. Mm. You know, they dream, like, I cannot wait to have like this moment on that carpet. It's their dream. you know, and that's like, and I respect that, but it's not my dream, you know. It was amazing. It was an epic accomplishment, but like, I want to make movies, like blockbuster pictures. Like, I want to have like the biggest brand out of Africa in the world. Like, until I'm seeing like my brand like on like, like at the airport, billboards, like that's not what I could say. Oh, you're cool. The pound the back, you know what I'm saying? But until then, I still literally feel like the intern at Virgin Records. Still, I don't feel any different than he does.
Wow.
I feel I'm still on the journey. So when I say that Paris was high school, I would say LA was college, and I feel like I graduated college this year.
Wow.
This is my graduation this year. That was my graduation.
That was a graduation.
That's a great way to graduate.
That was my graduation. That was my thesis. That was my graduation thesis paper. And now it's like for the first time ever, like that's why this is so significant for me, this interview. It's like for the first time ever, I feel like I am really doing it. Like I'm finally exercising what my purpose is, you know.
And it's through your brand. That's how you feel.
Through my brand, through my creation, through the brands that I own, through my film I'm producing, like the things that I'm putting out to leave on this world. You know, it's great to like, you know, dress a superstar for a tour and all these things, but it's like, what happens the next year? You know what I'm saying? Like, these moments are just moments. You know, the moments are great to look back at, but no one's life is being changed from a red carpet like hit, from a best dressed list. Like, no one's life is being changed. Let's be real about it. You know, so that's like for me, I know that like my purpose is more aligned to something that is more impactful to human beings, besides like a vanity or like inspiring your mood board on what to wear. You know, it's a bit bigger than that.
That's a beautiful way to end. And I want to now ask you, we ask every Afropolitan guest, who do you want to see on this couch? Whose story would you love to be told?
I would love to see the artist Kehinde Wiley. Yeah, I think that Kehinde is such a dynamic person. Like, he has like his personality is so interesting, and his story is so interesting. I think that we will be great to see that. I haven't heard him really talk and really just let it out before. I think he'd be a great person.
Kehinde Wiley.
Well, in this house we have art, so I wouldn't mind one of his pieces, you know.
Me neither.
Lugo, thank you so much for stopping by, bro. We're honored,
thank
man.
You. Thank this you. This was beautiful. This
it was
beautiful.
A pleasure. Thank y'all so much. Thank y'all.
Thank you.